Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts here on this channel. Today we are speaking with Joe. Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts here on this channel. Today we are speaking with Joe Cohen about his new book, Financial Crisis in American Households: The Basic Expenses That Bankrupt the Middle Class. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I was hoping you could start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm an associate professor of sociology at Queens College in the City University of New York. And I completed my doctorate at Princeton, and I'm originally from Canada. I've been here maybe since 2000, so coming up 17 years in the United States. And most of my work involves, you know, comparing the policies and, you know, the economic fortunes of regular people, comparing Canadians and Americans, middle class people. So, you know, that's what I do. That's where I'm at. And I run a sociology themed podcast myself. If your listeners are interested in more podcasting, check us out. The Annex Sociology Podcast is what we're called. And on iTunes and Google Play.
Nice. Yeah. The commercials are always fun to give, but it's a great podcast. I enjoy listening to it myself. So, can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about how this book came about for you? Like, what happened that made you want to write this, or just, you know, sort of the event that started it?
Sure, sure. It's, you know, this is one of those things where I was working on, you know, that big paper that I thought was going to be so important. And I was just fiddling with some data on the side. And I found a neat little finding about household spending and just where Americans were spending more of their money. And I wrote a little paper about it and sent it off to the ASAs while I continued to work on, you know, some big, what I thought was important paper that still isn't finished and I'm doubting it ever will be. So I, in the meantime, I sent out this paper and to the consumers and consumption section of the ASA for the annual meetings. And they included my paper in a showcase of papers that were being presented in the ASAs. And I was grateful that they did that. And some journalists started picking up on the findings of this paper. Basically, what the paper did was it looked at data from the America's Consumer Expenditure Survey. That's a diary survey where people track where they spend their money and how much they spend, and they and analysts use it to just get a sense of, you know, the structure of household spending and you know, things like that. And what I did was I took a look at the data to figure out, you know, where people are spending their money, and I was very much into this whole notion of consumerism and the idea that capitalism, you know, that there's that line that we've all heard, you know, capitalism gets people to buy things that they don't need and, you know, to keep the engine running and immiserate the population, things like that. And when I looked at when I looked at the data, there wasn't much growth in spending across most product categories. And I found that a lot of the spending that accounts for the growth of, American household spending was on a certain set of products. There was housing, the physical location, the structure of the housing, education, healthcare. Well, those were the three big ones. And then there's some smaller ones that have less impact on household budgets. And, I had trouble getting my head around that. You know, when you have a finding and you expect to find something else, and at the beginning, not finding that people were frittering away their money on cell phones and electronics was a source of frustration. But as I said, I'm Canadian, and I've come into contact a few times with American healthcare. And even though I have insurance, I've just gotten staggering bills. You know, for the birth of your child, it's very expensive for those of your listeners that aren't in the United States. Routine things like, basic diagnostics or the delivery of a baby or small procedures. You know, if you run into one healthcare provider that isn't on your plan, you could be out thousands of dollars. And it occurred to me that healthcare and education, two areas of spending that are very, very expensive in the United States compared to Canada. What might be driving that rising spending is increased prices. We know that cost of education is spiraling up, as is healthcare. We don't notice that these types of expenses happen because they happen once in a while, and we see them as sort of like a one in a million or like a long shot or a turn of bad luck, but not our normal economic circumstances. But what happens is over the course of people's life cycles, you do get big bills, medical bills and big educational bills, and those can have lasting consequences. So that's where the idea came from. And as is always the case, I was very proud of my finding. And then I found out that Elizabeth Warren had actually published a book earlier in some papers that found the same thing. So it wasn't really something that I discovered. But it was an idea that resonated with the media in the year that I presented at the ASA. And I was lucky enough to have some stories written about the paper. And then I had people approach me about writing a book, and I wrote it with Prager, my publisher.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. What I found interesting of it is this idea that, you know, there are a lot of media stories where it's like, oh, people are just out of control with their iPhones. Like, I don't know, the iPhone just seems like the easy target here. But it's like they're out of control buying new iPhones all the time. And I mean, yeah, sure, some people are. But I felt like, I mean, that's what sort of makes this a true blue sociology book, right? Is you're arguing sort of that, like, we have to also look at the structural and systemic issues that are happening here, that it's not so much just, you know, people are responding to the systems as well.
I'm sorry, you're cycling in and out, so I might be a problem with my connection or my headphones. Yeah, well, you know, that's something that people argue all the time. Or the other one that you hear a lot about is Starbucks, right? You know, why is everybody buying fancy coffees? And if only poor people would stop buying iPhones and lattes, they would be, they'd be able to save some money and scratch their way out of poverty. But really, you know, think of a health insurance plan. It's like $800 a month to cover a young couple. I remember that's what I was on when I was on Cobra, when I was changing jobs. This was maybe 10 years ago. I moved from Temple University to Queen's College. And I remember I had to pay Cobra. And for me and my wife at the time, we were young, it was $800 a month. That's a lot of coffees every month. Or that's a fresh iPhone. You know, you'd have to buy 12 iPhones a year, brand new iPhones a year to measure up to your very expensive and increasingly expensive healthcare plan.
Well, I actually had my first Canadian, because I just moved to Canada from the States, so I just had my first Canadian healthcare experience. It was interesting because, you know, they were going through my medical history and stuff, and for instance, I have colon cancer in my family, so I have to get tested. And it was interesting because I told the doctor about this, and she was like, just out of curiosity, how much did you pay for that? And I told her, and she was like, oh, no, it would be free here. And it just was sort of a classic example of just like she just couldn't believe that it cost me money to get something so preventative and important in my own history. So.
Yeah, you know, to a Canadian, I think it's a lot like asking somebody to pay to send their kid to grade one, you know, or to pay money to get access to the fire department. Like, it's seen as like a basic, you know, sort of basic infrastructure, a necessary service, like K-12 education here, or like policing services. But in the United States, it's treated like a privilege. There's a different cultural understanding. Of these services.
Yeah. Well, that's actually something you sort of mentioned in chapter one, is that you note that these costs are rising because they once were public, right? We used to have public pensions. Those are going by the wayside. Educational costs are becoming privatized. Childcare costs. I mean, there's multiple reports on how out of control childcare costs are. So I was hoping you could talk more about that, sort of like, you know, I think I wrote down this idea that like the free market failed regarding basic costs. So I was hoping you could start us off with that.
Yeah, you bet. So overall, the free market has done wonderful things for American living standards. But in these specific markets, they have not performed well. And one of the differences between the American government and a lot of other societies is the American government doesn't have a strong commitment to universal access to quality basic necessities. So the cost of educating people and the cost of healthcare have risen. Like, the Canadian government wrestles with it, the American government wrestles with it. Oh, you know, societies wrestle with it. In Canada, though, it is understood that the government is going to find a way to make sure that the burden of those rising costs do not fall on families such that they have to forego health care that they need. And in America, they don't have that same commitment to universal access to quality essentials. Many in American society think of health care as just a regular commercial service, and see it as, you know, it's not necessarily the government's job to shield people from rising costs. In fact, the Americans have some type of faith often that through competition and private enterprise innovation, that there'll be some type of wonderful, you know, breakthrough that will make healthcare, education, or any other product dirt cheap. And for most products, or for a lot of products, that's totally worked. Food is dirt cheap now. You know, education's very cheap. Reading materials are very cheap. Entertainment is very cheap. It's just in these specific markets, well, healthcare and education for sure. And housing is a different ball of wax that we could talk about, but healthcare and education, it just hasn't worked that well. It's ended up, you know, costs have been escalating and they're falling on the consumer's shoulders. And I think there's good reason to believe that people are either foregoing them or burying themselves in a mountain of debt, which has other damaging consequences.
Right. You actually mentioned that the American Value Survey shows that 3 out of 10 people don't go to the doctor because of the costs of it. That just seems crazy.
what are your impressions, like, what among your Canadian colleagues as an American who moved to that society, did it seem foreign to you, or?
I mean, it did, just in terms of being a new system to learn. But what I sort of thought, you know, like, I had to learn how to use the Bureau of Motor Vehicles here and how to get my, like, OHIP card, the Ontario health plan. But it's sort of like if you move to a different state, you know, like when I moved to Pennsylvania from Indiana, I still had to learn, like, that you can't get your license plate the same place you get your license, you know. So it's sort of like, if you've moved from different states, it sort of struck me like not as too different from that, and it wasn't like mind-blowingly different, but it was sort of like, oh, I gotta get a family doctor or go to a walk-in clinic. There's just small things, I think, that have been an adjustment, but like nothing's like, you know, I mean, everybody, I just ask people in my department and they'll just be like, oh, you gotta do this, you know, so it hasn't been too different, I don't think. But I mean, different in terms of, yes, the systems are, but learning it is mostly just that, you know, like, what do you do to start, I guess. But yeah, so One of the things, as a sociologist and somebody interested in measurement, that I want to talk about for a brief moment is this idea that you point out in the first chapter about, and we sort of talked about it with iPhones and lattes, is this idea of like what people ought to spend their money on. And you point out in your book that that matters for how we measure this stuff, right? Like what are we measuring? And then are we doing so objectively? I kind of think of the Heritage Foundation report that was like, poor people have microwaves. And it's like, well, yes, in this day and age, you need a microwave, basically, you know, like that's not, at least in my personal opinion, that's not like a luxury, right? That's almost a necessity. So thinking more about like, how do we measure like what are necessities and what are these, you know, consumer luxuries? So
yeah, to speak intelligently about, you know, people, you know, necessities or, you know, standards of living, you need to have some conception of what people need and don't need. And there's a lot of subjective judgment involved in that. You know, it might be that I believe that preventative medicine is something that is necessary, but you can absolutely construct a viable argument that's, you know, construes preventative medical care as something that is not necessary. Like Americans often say, well, you can go to the emergency room for free if you need to. Not for free, but you can go to the emergency room and not give your name, and the hotel or the hospitals are still compelled to treat you. Now that's a perspective, and there's no absolute rule that makes, you know, my view right and their view wrong. So you have to develop a standard, and the way I think about it is just be open with your readers about what you believe and try to develop something that's reasonable, something that, you know, isn't controversial. And what I settled at was anything that was necessary to stay alive or to gain some type of employment or sustenance so that you can, you know, support yourself into the future, get your necessities into the future through markets. So things that are necessary to either get and keep a job, to live indoors, food, clothing, things like that. I lay out a basket and that's what I work with. But I think the basic message is that it's complicated and it's fraught with value judgments. And if you develop a reasonable standard and are just explicit about it, I think, you know, readers will make their own judgments.
Right. Well, and I think sort of the middle class is the perfect example of that, right? Because I think in your book, you note that it ranges from somebody making anywhere from $12,000 a year to $700,000 a year. But a lot of that is like, well, if you're in New York City versus, you know, Hanover, Indiana, like what the difference of cost of living is and things like that. And that's why I feel like the middle class can range so much, is because, you know, you have to take into account those cost of living kind of issues.
You know, a lot of people talk about, we're in New York City, and a lot of people talk about how much more expensive it is to live in New York as opposed to somewhere else. And, you know, I think in the book I cite an article that just knocked my socks off in the New York Times about how it's hard to live on, it was written tongue in cheek, but how it's hard to live in New York City off of $500,000 a year. And the thing is that the average New Yorker earns like 55 grand a year instead of 45 grand a year. Like, New York is overwhelmingly populated by regular people earning five-digit incomes, right? And those people who earn $150,000 in New York are also privileged, you know, just like somebody earning $150 in Indiana would be. There's a very big pressure for everybody to self-identify with the middle class. And a lot of people earnestly believe that they're earning $300,000 and they're just a regular Joe. But the economic challenges that face somebody who earns $200,000-$300,000 a year are about maintaining their privileged position in society. It's not, there's no worry about, am I going to have a diet or be able to live indoors or, you know, even see a doctor if need be or hire a lawyer. It's more like, can I make sure that I'm still saving enough so that my kids can go to the private school that I aspire to send them to? or, you know, can I maintain residency in this really high performing school district that is doing so much better than, you know, regular school districts? It's about maintaining position of privilege rather than worrying about the essentials. And regular people, whether they're in New York City or Indiana, the overwhelming majority of them, I think, are worried about losing their home and not having enough money to, you know, make a down payment on another home, or running out of money to cover that bill, just absolutely running out and not being able to get things they need.
Mm-hmm. That actually brings up something that you talk about in chapter 3, which is that, you know, insecurity is not so black and white. So it's not just like, you know, that this one thing's going to happen. And here you talk about sort of, you know, that there's short-term precarious, long-term unsustainable, long-term sustainable. So I thought those were sort of interesting ways to think about it in terms of what is happening. Is somebody having like a medical emergency that bankrupts them? Is that a one-time thing? You know, or are they having precarious employment? So I was hoping you could talk more about those like sort of insecurities that play into this.
So that chapter starts off by talking about how subjective insecurity, financial insecurity, that means do you feel financially insecure or not, is not a great guide to anything. There are multimillionaires who feel financially insecure. And in some ways, anxiety about money can just be a spillover of somebody who's generally anxious, right? There's a lot going on there. But what I try to do in that chapter is establish some more objective standards, you know, standards that we can you know, identify and discuss and then measure the prevalence of. And so I develop a typology of levels of insecurity. And the lowest, so of course there are people who are poor and distressed, and the most basic level of insecurity, the highest level of insecurity, are people who are economically dependent. So that's people who basically need someone else to help them with the bills. Either it's a welfare program or a government assistance program or help from family or something like that. And a good portion of society, it's like a quarter of society, needs help to sustain themselves. And mostly it's, or a lot of it is the elderly who are living off of Social Security. And there's a big view in American culture that Social Security isn't government assistance. Like there's this big elaborate sort of, you know, fiction that there's some type of account that everybody was paying in, and, you know, they're getting their money, they're getting their returns on investments. But Social Security is just, it's a regular welfare, you know, welfare program. It taxes people who are working to give to a certain group that is believed to have difficulty in supporting themselves because they're not able to work. And those are disabled and elderly people. And so a lot of the elderly rely on that Social Security check. They rely on government programs that tax the working age population to keep them afloat. And if they didn't have those programs, they wouldn't be able to afford a basic livelihood on their own. A majority of elderly people are dependent on the government. And a lot of young people are dependent on their families. So that's economic dependency. That's the most insecure. Another quarter or so of people are short-term insecure. And those are people who maybe have they're living paycheck to paycheck, or maybe they got one paycheck in the bank. But they could get – these are people who have like they might own a house. They might own a car. But they got $500 to $1,000 in the bank. Right. And if they have to do something like make bail or, you know, replace their roof or something, you know, just one of those routine major multi-$1,000 expenses that can pop up in life, they don't have the money to cover it. Now, long-term unsustainable is probably another 30%. So we're talking like the median to like the 80th percentile, let's say in rough terms. These are people who do have assets and they, you know, they got a regular job and they got a little bit of money in the bank, but they're mostly invested in their house, and houses are typically poor performing assets. There was a little boom, but generally, you know, the problem with houses is if you sell that asset, you need money and you sell it. Well, where are you going to live, right? So they have cars and they have houses. But what they're not doing is they're not accumulating enough money to not be dependent on the government in old age, right? They don't have a 401k. You know, they don't have an IRA. And there's a, a very, very large number of people who think that they're secure, but they don't realize that they are not prepared for sort of that back, you know, the last portion of their life, when the time between when they exit the labor market and when they pass away.
I saw a study, I can never remember, I should figure out who it was, but I saw a study a long time ago that asked people if they were getting government assistance. And like you said, most people don't see Social Security as government assistance. They don't see things like Pell Grants and I think it's the Stafford loans that, you know, are government assistance. So it was just really kind of eye-opening, because I think that that's part of the issues that a lot of times people don't understand, right?
Totally. That's very different from Canada. And I think it's a very politically powerful difference in perspective. In Canada, everybody understands that their health care comes from the government, or that, you know, university is heavily subsidized. So in a sense, regular people see themselves as the beneficiary of public assistance or social programs. What's happened in the United States is that there's just been this elaborate narrative that has sought to make the social assistance programs that people generally get be construed as, you know, not assistance. And assistance programs have become racialized, like the programs that go to explicitly to the poor are the ones that are more readily identified with the government and are, you know, more widely opposed in the United States. And I think that has an effect on politics. It has an effect of sowing opposition to government programs from those who would benefit from those programs. You know, I'm thinking of that, you know, those poor communities where everybody wants to undo the Affordable Care Act, even though the Affordable Care Act was giving them, you know, subsidized health care.
Well, and it's interesting to think you sort of move into chapter four in terms of what you call the big picture. And I think that this is sort of important, right? Because the first thing you start off with is the exhaustion of the World War II economy. And I feel like that's often used, right? Like, well, we just need to get back to that era. And it's sort of like, well, that era is gone. There were a lot of things happening, you know, the global competition, the taxes, and the policy were all different because the economy was different at the time. So I was hoping you could sort of talk about these, you know, you mentioned World War II economy, like globalization, technology, sort of these social things that have put us in the position where we are now economically.
Yeah. So the purpose of this chapter is to engage that narrative of why regular Americans aren't doing well, because, the people, a lot of people enter discussions about why the middle class is struggling with very strongly held preconceived ideas. And often those preconceived ideas have, political ramifications, and often get people in a very partisan or, you know, simplistic mindset when they're thinking about the problem. And what I tried to do here was to communicate that the problems facing the middle class, it's complicated. There's a lot of them. Government can't solve all of them. But ultimately, what the government can do is it can help buffer people from these pressures. So let's start with the pressure. So there's a lot of reasons why the middle class isn't doing well compared to, I don't know when America was supposed to be great, but I guess the golden age, if you look at the data, looks like it was the 50s and 60s. But there, you know, there was a lot going on in the 50s and 60s. Like, the rest of the world's economies were completely destroyed, and America was pretty much, you know, the last major industrialized economy that wasn't wiped out, and it was in a very powerful position, and it faced very little competition. And there was a lot of wartime technologies that were converted to civilian use. So there's a lot of great things, or economically advantageous things, that, you know, they weren't going to stay around forever. It's not like Japan and Europe were not going to rebuild. And it's a good thing that America and Japan rebuild it, you know. The end of the sort of the bonus that American capitalism enjoyed as a result of having been the last major economic power standing. That's one reason why things aren't as good today as they were several decades ago. There are more people who are there are more older people. Older people have more money problems. There are more people who are living alone, which is a predictor of financial difficulty. There is globalization, and I know that was a big thing during the election. A lot of people blamed the American workers' diminishing fortunes on globalization. But there's also technological advancement. You know, a lot of jobs are getting automated or computerized. There are a lot of factors, but one – what the book concludes with, though, is that, you know, some of these factors, though, might be government policies that are not effectively confronting these bigger picture challenges. So sure, maybe the government can't make the population young, and maybe it's a good thing that people can get divorced or that people aren't, you know, thrust into families. And maybe we don't want to artificially increase the marriage rate, and we don't want to stop technology. And, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to engage in globalization. So, you know, maybe what we have to do is we have to look towards government policies that help, you know, solidify or regular Americans' living standards to at least buffer us from these shocks. And on this front, I don't think that the general direction of U.S. policy over the past 30 years has done a good job of doing that. You know, America now has a very big poverty problem, like an absolute poverty problem. It has a low life expectancy for a wealthy country. Yeah, so I guess that's the main thrust of it was it's not all the government's fault, but it might be somewhat the government's fault in that they have failed to help equip us to deal with the challenges that we face.
And so this sort of ties into your fifth chapter, which is this idea of this runaway spending, right? But I think the data that you provide in your tables is pretty convincing that it's not this runaway spending. I actually loved this quote that you pulled from somebody else that said it's our Lipitor, not our lattes. I just really liked the sound of that. But yeah, so you point out, you know, that household spending has actually only risen by 6%. And that, you know, I mean, if you think about it, because things are cheap, because we've got those Costco jeans, you know, like what is happening? If people aren't spending all their money on that, what are they spending their money on? And I think your figures are pretty striking if you want to talk about, you know, the healthcare and childcare and education spending.
Yeah. And housing. Like, I think Americans, they don't overspend on housing, but they overinvest on housing. Yeah, but you know what? You know what's it? So that was the original paper that I described earlier. But you know, there's an interesting implication to that finding, and it's that if healthcare and if education weren't getting so expensive, and if Americans were not paying big welfare penalties by living below their means in terms of housing, like if bad neighborhoods still had decent schools, right? It could be that real wages would have been increasing because general living costs would have been falling. Like globalization, automation, those changes have made stuff really cheap. And had we been able to just contain those other costs, it might have been that Americans would have enjoyed a faster rising living standard, and we wouldn't have had as stagnant real wages as we experienced.
Well, because part of the other issue that you bring up here is this, and you've mentioned it before, is this idea that it's like, are people buying better quality stuff, right? So like you said, are they staying in that really expensive neighborhood because it's tied to the good school, or are they sending their kid to the private childcare? So I think that that's sort of an interesting way to think about it is like, what are we spending our money on these basic costs?
Yeah. Yeah. Housing, that sort of misconception is really prevalent, where a lot of people think about how houses are big or how we furnish our housing with things that we didn't have. You know, you could imagine an old person saying, why do you need 5 flat screen TVs? We didn't have it back in the day. But those things are actually cheap, right? IKEA is cheap. I can furnish a home, you know, for far less than I could 30, 40 years ago. I remember, you know, our local furniture stores were higher end and had nicer stuff. We didn't have like $100 dining sets like you have at IKEA. Or, you know, beds that you could just assemble yourself for, you know, the equivalent of today's $150. The what really matters is the location, all right? Real estate's about location, location, location. And it's important for a lot of reasons. One is when you live with richer people, the social services and the local social services generally are better financed because in the United States, a lot of local taxes pay for local services. And some states, like my own state in New Jersey, will try to equalize things. Like they'll make rules where they say a wealthy county can spend more per student in their school system than a poor county like Newark or Camden. But the thing is that poor people need more public resources, right? It's more expensive to give a poor person the equivalent education educational opportunities because richer people self-finance opportunities. Like in my, I live in a Better Heeled community of New Jersey in Morris County, and like the parents buy their kids the iPads. They don't need the school to provide them iPads. But yeah, you know, you need that in a poor county. So even when you equalize, it's not really equalizing educational opportunities. It's basically equalizing dollar per student spent when the needs are very different. So you want, so there's that, there's the social services. And there's also just the question of, you know, during the 2008 crisis, poorer neighborhoods were more likely to be affected by foreclosures and were more likely to see the value of their homes fall. And that's a big deal because if I'm not mistaken, the average home, the figure's in the book, but the average homeowner is 70% invested in their house, right? Like if your home value falls, your wealth is destroyed. And so your wealth is more insulated, or there's good reason to believe that your wealth is more insulated when you live in a wealthier neighborhood. So I think what's happening is everybody in the United States is trying to cram into the best possible neighborhood they can afford, even though it might make more financial sense to buy a cheaper house and put that money in the stock market where it would appreciate more quickly.
Right. Well, you sort of bring that up in the book, right, that the wealthy become wealthy because they have diverse investments. And so that it's, you know, if one thing happens, it doesn't just sort of bankrupt all of their investments. But towards the end of the book, I think you sort of turn your eye to looking abroad, right? So I think it's easy to think, oh, you know, the U.S., like we used to be great, like what's happening now? But it's important to sort of put us in the world context. And you mentioned here that the U.S. is rich but unequal. So, you know, I mean, in my postdoc now, I'm studying European policies for aging. And I mean, basically, everybody else is doing a lot more socially. And so I was hoping you could sort of talk about how you see that benefiting other countries and not benefiting the U.S. or, you know, how the U.S. is using their policies to support people financially. So,
right. Well, you know, I think, there are problems with very poor people falling through the cracks. But the American system, you know, let's just say the average person who might be long-term insecure but can afford to cover their basic bills. America has a decent school system. It's got decent health care in communities that aren't distressed. It's average. You know, it's in America, you know, again, this book was trying to be conversant with an American audience. And Americans, at least on economic matters, and economic policy matters, strike me as very extreme in their thinking, right? It's either all the government's the bad guy, or free market capitalism's the bad guy, or like America's the best, or America's the pits, right? And my whole thing with all of this book is, you know, listen, look at the data and see where things are and just be reasonable about, you know, your impressions of what's happened and how things are going. And if you look at the data, America's average for a rich country. It's nothing special. It's nothing bad, right? The rich countries, they all have good health care. They all have good university systems. Again, this is if you are not in one of America's distressed neighborhoods, because, I mean, all societies have pockets of absolute poverty. Like Canada has a terrible problem with its native population, right? And in America, there is a very large underclass. But for regular people, they're getting something good. But the problem is it's super expensive. And the threat of that cost just, it puts people under the gun. Like if they lose their job, if, you know, something happens, they could easily be cut off. So Americans, they're getting decent, you know, this system where governments don't do much and they purchase things on their own. Like Americans are surviving. It's not like living standards are bad here, but they're not better than anybody else. For all of the stress that Americans are incurring and all the risk that they live with, the wonders of free market capitalism are not delivering better quality or lower prices. It's generating average results at really inflated prices.
So I was hoping you could actually sort of like give us your big takeaways, because I really felt like one of the the main points of the book is that sort of like we have to pay attention to healthcare, education, and housing because they are pretty essential, right? Like, so they're sort of, I don't know, the building blocks of everything else. So I was hoping you could sort of tell us, you know, like what you really, after doing all this research, felt like were sort of the next steps, or just like what we should be thinking about in terms of our system and government programming.
So the more that I, you know, think about and talk about the book, especially with general audiences, like at the end of the day, the book intends to push American audiences to just identify very specific problems that I think if we're sober about how well the education system is functioning, how well this free market education system is functioning, how well this free market healthcare system is functioning, I think that any reasonable person will realize that they're not doing well, this free market system. Now, that doesn't mean that capitalism isn't doing well. And I'm one of the main messages is that, you know, argue for a practical approach where we don't make this about capitalism versus socialism or Republicans versus Democrats, but rather be practical and say, listen, the economy is not performing well in specific ways. And if we look at other countries, we see that they're doing a better job. And maybe we can help ourselves by emulating successes abroad. And I think that countries that heavily subsidized higher education and engage in price controls and subsidies in healthcare, I think they're doing better when all said and done. I don't think that their governments are poor. I don't think that their economies are less dynamic. It's not like we have to throw away our freedom or we have to throw away all capitalism if we're going to talk about implementing, you know, single-payer healthcare or free higher ed. It's just in these specific areas, they're not doing well. So let's try something else, and let's try something that this, you know, people in other countries have already tested and they seem to work pretty well. So it's sort of like at the end of the day, I think at its root, it's engaging a lot of partisan political arguments in the United States, and it's advocating for just sort of like a level-headed pragmatism, and to, you know, just think soberly about things.
Cool. So was there anything else you sort of wanted the reader to take away from your book, or, you know, spark any sort of ideas for them?
No, you know, like this is not a book that is, you know, I'm not making any big theoretical statements, and I'm not unpackaging and taking on Karl Marx or anything like that. I would say for people who are listening and thinking about how they want to write, know that you have colleagues in this discipline who are interested in just empirics, level-headed empirics, and plain language explanations, and engaging social problems on the level that you don't need a doctorate to understand the explanation, like simple, straightforward explanations that anybody with an undergraduate can understand, and, you know, a lot of empirics. So you sometimes there's some more flamboyant sort of big theorists or out there, things like that. And you might think that that's what everybody's like, but there's definitely room for empirics. There's definitely room for, you know, just level-headed, you know, low to middle range, sensible conversations. And if you're a quant like I am, who likes that stuff, I say go for it. You know, you'll find a market for your book, or you'll find a market for your research if that's the type of thinking and discussing that you like to do.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Well, thanks again for being here to talk about your book today. What are you working on now?
So I have I'm on my sabbatical. I just got there. I'm going to go on my sabbatical next year. And I am blending my two loves, which are Canadian-American well-being studies and podcasting into one project, where I'm hoping to have a series of expert interviews, run a podcast series where I interview experts on, you know, the details of studying, comparing, and thinking about quality of life differences. And then I'm going to add that to a quantitative study of Canadian and U.S. Living standards and personal finances. I'm going to go up to Canada, dig into their spending and personal finance data sets, and take a look at the middle class and ask who's doing better, the Canadian or the American middle class. And the answer is they're doing better in different ways. So it's like, in what ways, and what do the two countries have to learn from each other?
Cool. Those sound like cool projects. Well, thanks again for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being on the show.
Yeah. Thanks again.